Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for listening to Missing on the Crawl Space Media Network.
If you like this show, you will love Crawl Space, which is also hosted by us.
We launched Crawl Space in 2017, and we have a huge catalog of incredible and thought-provoking interviews.
Check out our entire network of shows at crawlspace-media.com. On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass Amherst student Maura Murray disappeared in the White Mountains of New Hampshire in one of the most perplexing mysteries of our time.
For years, we have covered Maura's case and the tireless online community that surrounds it in great detail. We have since expanded our mission with this series, raising awareness and shining a light on the stories of other missing persons.
We now sit on the board of directors of the nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing, which was founded by Bruce Maitland. Bruce's daughter, Brianna Maitland, went missing from Montgomery, Vermont on March 19th of 2004, just 6 weeks after and about 80 miles away from where Maura Murray vanished.
Private Investigations for the Missing aims to assist with investigations for underserved families whose missing loved ones have been forgotten by the media or by law enforcement. Through our growing community, we hope to shed a light on these cold cases.
Families and loved ones can reach out to us at investigationsforthemissing.org. This is Missing. Welcome back to Missing. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
Tim, I couldn't be any better. If I was any better, guess what? I'd be you. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great as well, Lance. And for this episode, we speak with the new investigators on staff who are volunteering for Private Investigations for the Missing. They are working on the disappearance of Phoenix Colden from Spanish Lake, Missouri in December of 2011. And they were a part of the previous two episodes we released in Phoenix Colden's disappearance. Of course, we also had Goldia Colden, Phoenix's mom, on those episodes, so we didn't hear too much from the Wylands. But Vanessa and Andrew Wyland are in this episode, and it's just them, and it's probably going to be a two-parter, and I think it's very informative.
Oh, it totally is, and I love the fact that we are doing this series now on a missing person, and we've introduced the missing person, we've introduced members of the family all through Private Investigations for the Missing. And the previous episodes, we introduced Goldia Colden, the incomparable Goldia Colden. She had an incredible interview with us, really opened up, and hopefully there'll be more conversations with that strong woman. And now I feel like unofficially in my head, I'm taking this as an Meet the Investigators segment of Private Investigations for the Missing and the awareness that we're putting out there. So you meet the missing person, you meet the family or friends, maybe a journalist, but now you should know where the investigators are coming from. And the Wylands are such a cool couple with their great organization, Lakefront Investigations, and they are doing a wonderful job managing both the investigation of Phoenix's disappearance and the relationship between us and the Coldens.
And check out their site at lakefrontinvestigative.com. And why don't you check out Investigations for the Missing, too, PIs for the Missing. Check them out at investigationsforthemissing.org. This wonderful couple, the Wylands, recently volunteered, and this is now the second case that they're working on with PIs for the Missing. They actually solved the first case that they worked on for PIs for the Missing, Lance, very, very quickly, which we discussed a little bit in this interview.
Well, they're nothing if not efficient and thorough, and they get along really well. It's really fun, if that's a good word to use, to watch their dynamic. And I learned that Andy smokes a pipe with tobacco in it like Sherlock Holmes, which is also very, very cool.
Yeah, they do have great personalities as well, and it's nice to see them bounce off each other. So I hope you find this interview informative, and we're going to be back with more coverage on the disappearance of Phoenix Colden. We are not done by a long shot here. And please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody.
And check out all of our fine programs at crawlspace-media.com.
Welcome back to the podcast, Vanessa and Andrew Wyland. How are you today?
Wonderful. Thank you. How are you guys?
Doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having us back.
Oh, you're welcome back anytime. And it is pronounced Wyland.
It is. Still.
Okay. Still. Okay, good. Because it looks just like Wieland.
Mm. Oh. So I've heard Wieland.
Yeah.
Vanessa.
Most people say Wayland, and I actually just answer to it. I don't even correct it now. So
it was my fault the first time we interviewed. I probably should have asked. I definitely assumed Wayland at first.
If anybody were to correct Tim on how to pronounce your last name, Goldia Colden was probably the right person to have it stick in place for the rest of your life. You'll never forget that last name now.
It's a great point. I will forever ask before we start rolling. Thank you, Goldia.
she is a badassery on another level, just with all the things that she's done in her life and with everything that's happened. She definitely, you can see that California social worker come through very often. So bless her heart.
Lance, you when you had talked to her, you had said something that was difficult, that might for some people have been difficult to recover from. I feel like you handled that very professionally and very compassionately. It was something, and she did too, you know, in her way. She's been struggling with that too. It is, I think, human nature. When we're talking about historical events, it's human nature to slip into the past tense. But it is very important to the Coldens. It's very important to us, to all of us at Private Investigations for the Missing too, right? That we do carry forward that kind of underlying belief that we are going to find that person. We're going to find that person alive and well, because that's what keeps us moving. And it's what I believe to be true as well. I believe that not to get too far ahead of us, forgive me, but I do believe that Phoenix is alive and well.
Oh, and I do as well. And to use the person in the past tense, and I knew it the second I said it. The second I said it, and I said it in the same sentence, was to is. I corrected myself, but then she made sure she corrected me as well, that she was not going to carry on the conversation if we referred to her in the past tense. And it was a quick slip that she didn't let go, and I 100% appreciate her not letting that go, because I really feel like that has to be stressed as well, that when people cover missing person cases, all too often they say, they refer to the person in the past tense. I even try now to not even use the word case, missing person cases. And I'm still working on that. I try to use stories, a missing person story or a missing person event, something like that. Something because cases, I just feel like just lumps them in to all the cases, cold cases, open cases, closed cases. It's just very impersonal. But no, she, much like your last name, I will probably never make that mistake again, because the image of her face hovering around me when I'm talking about one of these missing persons, it will never go away. When I saw her face change when I said it, and I was like, damn it. No, damn it.
Yeah. And if that was an uncomfortable moment for you, and you both had a learning moment from Goldia, please imagine, just put yourselves in our shoes for a moment. Goldia has taught us a lot of lessons. And she has learned some lessons from us too, I will say, Vanessa, that we've really come together as a team. We're coming together still as a team. But I personally can't say enough nice things about Goldia. I just think she's a fantastic person, and Lawrence is a fantastic person. Of course, the extent to which we know our clients is limited to Zoom calls, phone calls, emails and texts, but hopefully, like Goldia had talked about and Lawrence had mentioned to you all previously when we privately all spoke with Lawrence, that Vanessa and I will get an opportunity to sit down and maybe break bread with him soon.
Okay, so you haven't met yet. Can we ask a little bit about your background? Where are you guys from and where are you currently?
I'm from all over. I'm an Army brat. And of course, we raised our children as Air Force brats. I think I still, to this day, claim Texas as home. Although, you know, I really was raised mostly between Germany, North Carolina, and New York. But we lived the longest in Texas. That's where we created most of our children's memories and things like that. So, but right now we are on the East Coast up in Maryland. Some say South, some say East Coast, depending on what part of Maryland you're in. But that's where we are right now. That's where we're licensed.
Very good. Well, Maryland is a wonderful state, and you two are wonderful people. You are part of the Private Investigations for the Missing team now. How did you get involved with PIs for the Missing? I guess take us back to how you got involved with investigations in the first place.
Oof, man. So I guess for me, I dragged Andy into this a bit, kicking and screaming a little bit, you know, moving away from the DOD side to the civilian side, I guess. So I've always kind of been interested in doing this sort of work, but between school and work and things like that, up until a few years ago, just the time wasn't there. I did volunteer with like the Sheriff's Department, the Crisis Intervention Unit, as a child court-appointed special advocate for children, things like that. So I've been kind of skirting around the sort of, I guess, this area for a while. And when we got here, we just kind of got clued into cases mostly dealing around, I would say, not just African-American girls and boys that were going missing, but I think that the factor is the poverty line. So a lot of kids that are in the system for various reasons, race, of course, has to do with it, class or income had a lot to do with it. And so just people that were maybe falling below, for lack of a better word, the cut line, that were going missing or disappearing, or unfortunately that were murdered. And it didn't seem like a lot of attention was being paid to those cases. And when they were, a lot of it became about the victim, the victim's history, or the things that they might have done that are skirting, you know, proper, maybe, you know, proper etiquette or manners, those kinds of things. And I think that in all of those peoples, we saw children, you know, they weren't 18 or 23. They were our kids. That led me to a group called Trace Labs. And I've talked to you guys about that before, crowdsourcing missing persons. And I know a lot of people are kind of anti-Reddit Bureau of Investigations and anti-crowdsourcing law enforcement work, but they really set up a great platform for people to come together and use their skills in OSINT, in active, I guess, more active measures to kind of find missing people and to have people put a little skin in the game. So I got involved with that, told Andy about it. He really seemed to like it, but didn't participate as much because he's more of an active hands-on person. And so then we looked a little bit more, seeing how we could get more involved. And that led me to Lou Berry and Bruce in Private Investigations for the Missing. And so we went and got our PI licenses and talked to Bruce and Lou, and the rest is history.
I like how you said we went and got our private investigator licenses. What's the process? Because you made it sound like you went and bought one at the supermarket. Is there a process in place?
So honestly, so in Maryland, you do have to... You have to go through a certain set of training with a licensed private investigations agency. They have to be allowed to train and all of that kind of stuff. The Maryland State Police own the process. So you go into this training, and I believe it's got to be 42 hours, if I'm not mistaken, 40 or 42 hours. So it's a whole week. Normally, it's a whole week. We, of course, did several weeks of lessons. And then you also have to kind of outline like your history. So there's background checks and that sort of thing. Many of the folks that went through class with us, they did it for to get their concealed carry. And so it kind of it sort of serves both purposes. You could do it for more security, or you could do it for more private investigation. After the background checks are done and all of that, then you get your license. So of course we are not our own agency. We work for another agency, but they have allowed us quite a lot of latitude based on our backgrounds and working with PI FTM.
It sounds pretty cool. And so I got a couple of questions. Andrew, I think you said OSINT. I'm curious what that is. And I also want to know how you both complement each other as investigators. I guess what I'm asking is, what are your strengths?
From OSINT, we're talking, you know, of course, open source intelligence. And that's something that I'll be honest, going back to my early career in the military as an intelligence military intelligence guy. I jokingly, my buddies and I jokingly considered the OSINT folks kind of, they're the ones that read newspapers and tell everybody what's going on in the world. Thanks for reporting the news. Fast forward 20 some years and some maturity of thought, OSINT's a very powerful tool, incredibly powerful tool. Especially as you know, that was my jokes and aside, that was my view back in 1990, between 98 2001 maybe. I was even doing coding at that time on the side for fun, you know, to kind of learn how to code and stuff. But 20 some years forward, it's probably one of the most important tools that any investigator, whether you're doing it for military intelligence, you know, government intelligence activities, or investigations at the state, local level, U.S. level, it's an incredible tool. So Vanessa can speak more specifically about it, because she's been studying it so closely. And it is an area that I'm very interested in personally. I just haven't gotten that depth of knowledge and experience that Vanessa's had.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Andy captured it all there. And I think that it's not necessarily just the maturity of thought for people, but it's the maturity of our information systems, I guess. So we've moved from a non-internet to an internet age. And then along with that, people have developed a taste for what I like to say is relentless self-promotion, which is a good thing for us as investigators, right? They're constantly posting, constantly, you know, videotaping themselves. And we could see with the recent events in the Capitol, you know, OSINT is a lot more than translating foreign language newspapers. You know, we're in a second or third wave even of what open source information means and what it can do. And so a lot of times, you know, they like to call computer people or people that do digital forensics or open source intelligence, that kind of thing. They call those kinds of investigators like armchair detectives. But honestly, a lot of the things that we should be doing, a lot of the things that we do now, we should start with all of the information that's online. Otherwise, if we're just going out and canvassing, you know, interviewing without that background knowledge, we're doing a disservice to our clients.
But you are talking mostly about social media when you're talking about that at this point, right? What people choose to share.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of it is cloaked in, you know, oh, look at my bullet journal, you know, and I'm going to be selling these things on the side. So it's great for us to see that because we're actually getting the most out of people. It's, you know, because they're making it a business, because they are making it. I mean, a lot of people can't connect in person, so they're doing it online. They're trying for that sort of human connection, and so I mean that's great for us. Not to, you know, not to say it meanly or anything like that, but especially when we were doing the trace lab, some of the CTFs. I mean, we were able to find locations, the current locations of these people that were listed as missing because they, you know, make a, you know, a kid makes a separate Facebook account thinking that their parents wouldn't notice, but we could notice, we could see, we could track it down and, you know, able to provide current location data.
And I want to, I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole of what happened on January 6th at the Capitol, but what were your thoughts when you watched the footage that started coming out in the subsequent days where people were actually showing their face like a selfie, showing what was happening, using their own names in these videos and then posting them on social media? What were your thoughts? How do you think that they knew that they were committing this crime?
I know for me, all I could think of was, man, you guys are worried about 5G. You're your own worst enemy. Like that's all I could really think about.
As a defense contractor, retired, now military, I can say whatever I want. Yes. First of all, my initial reaction was, I was sick. All of my colleagues and friends and brothers and sisters were just sick. And that's kind of where, when you even mentioned it, when you brought it up, I know that there was a part of me that just shut down because I was focused. I was hard focused on that event. Disgusting. Do they now, to your point though, right? Do I think that they understood the full gravity and the second and third and fourth order of effects that stem from putting your face out there? Your whole face, your countenance, everything, your whole intention. That's amazing. There is when we're talking about cyber type things, right? Cyber type considerations and monitoring behavior. And that's OSINT too, right? Monitoring online behaviors and looking at just watching what groups and people are doing. We knew that leading up to this, that this group of people were talking actively laying out, we're going to do this. And then we're going to do this. And then we're going to do this. They were putting that on social media. I won't cast blame on any group of people, even though I can as a private citizen. I'm free to do that. Professionally, that's not nice. But I don't know what happened. I wasn't in those rooms with those analysts as this information was being looked at. I don't know if the information was even seen. But the fact that these folks walked into that building, which I consider sacred, I consider it a sacred building. you know, I understand that's possibly contentious. I consider it a sacred building for America, for the United States, and for them to go in there and put their faces out in public, knowing full well that they were going to take full, they believed they were hard locked in their upside down beliefs, hard locked. So long answer, long opinion to your very simple question. Do I think that they understood what they were doing? Yeah, of course they understood what they're doing. They thought they were on the winning side of history. And I'm telling you, they're not. And this is the last thing I'll say, and then I'll jump off my soapbox, gentlemen, and Vanessa. I will tell everybody that, yes, there are these groups of people that have done this thing on January 6th, 2020. There are groups of people out there that subscribe to these types of thoughts who think that that's the right side of history to belong on, to be on. But we, Vanessa and I, we have a lot of friends, and there are more of us than there are of them. And we have much more resources at our disposal. So please, America, don't think for a moment that we are under siege by this small group, that we cannot contain them. We took on ISIS. We took on all these other groups. We can contain this small little, these people who are just upside down. And that is all I have to say about that, gentlemen. Forgive me for jumping on a soapbox.
No apologies necessary. That was an incredible answer and opinion. And really, that's we don't often get the opportunity to ask questions like that to people who have connections like yourself and like Vanessa and experience. So just getting that and hearing it is very valuable for us.
I am curious because the Phoenix Colden case or Phoenix's disappearance is not the first missing person case you've covered for PIs for the Missing. Is that right?
So we did cover one case. It actually was a wouldn't even say it was a case. So one of the problems I think that we have is an overload of information problem, right? So it's good and it's bad. And sometimes like people, they do these true crime blogs or they do, they make these missing persons websites and things like that, and they don't get updated. And the same can go for many other websites that even like government websites. And so one of the folks, and I won't say his name, but he was a local case, listed as missing, listed as much younger than he actually is. And so I brought that one to Lou, and we talked about it, and we said that we were going to go and find. So we worked together. That was actually the first one that I worked on with him, and found that this young gentleman actually was not missing. He was alive, working. You know, he had had issues in the past. Both he and his sister were frequent, as they said, runaways. And so that would have been the first one, but I worked that with Lou, more so. And that was just about the time that Andy was coming on board with PIFTM.
And so he didn't know he was missing. Is that kind of how I understand it?
So there are, and I also don't want to publicize this site because it actually is doing very, very good work. But he was listed on a very prominent site that features, some of the under the cut line children that we were talking about before, and he was still listed as missing. And so it was a simple, all right, I'm going to attack all of the local cases that I can find. Once I found that one, I decided to kind of go through. And yes, he was not aware that he was listed as missing. One thing that I will say, though, and I think that this is important, there are children that have parents that maybe aren't going to, that are maybe not as involved as the Coldens, or they are part of a system, a juvenile, you know, justice system, or they're in the Child Protective Services, where they're just a number, unfortunately, in that system. And so they're not getting that kind of, that same sort of publicity even that other children would get. You know, there are no pictures of them, or they're very outdated pictures, or they're very bad pictures. So you couldn't even tell if you passed by them on the street. So I tried my best to focus on some of those harder cases. And so that's why that one particularly came up, just based off of some of the little information we had. He seemed to be an institutionalized child. And so that's why it just kind of struck home with me.
Is that something that you find is common, the institutionalization of people who are currently missing?
I don't think that it's, I wouldn't say that it's common. I would just say maybe those are the ones that kind of tug a little bit at me, because I mean, we're talking about kids with normal, happy families, even those aren't getting publicized. So imagine what it's like for somebody who thinks that they were thrown away by society or thrown away by their families. And so I think that sometimes I want to focus on those stories more so, because there is a story there, and they should know that there are people out there that are thinking of them and that do care.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos. I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field. And we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Well, let's discuss Phoenix Colden's disappearance. And as we know, and we've referenced already, the first two episodes of our series, I guess, on Phoenix's story, we had Goldia as our guest, along with both of you. She's great to talk to. She's got a lot of information. And where has this case led both of you? Andrew, you mentioned earlier you believe Phoenix is out there alive and well. I guess what I'm asking is, how did you get to that point where you believe that?
You know, I have to apologize. We have no evidence to suggest anything right now. I'll be honest with you. There's no evidence to suggest one way or the other the fate of Phoenix Colden. At this point right now, it's a sense of belief, and I share that sense of belief with Goldia and Lawrence, that Phoenix is alive and well. And that is the best answer that, unfortunately, that's the best answer I can give you, because there is a lack of strong evidence available to us as investigators to really make any concrete conclusions one way or the other.
When the case was laid out to you, how was it laid out? Meaning, were you presented with the circumstances leading up to the day she disappeared before you heard any evidence or details of the car or any phone call or any the video that's out there? What were the order of events?
Really, it was just a kind of an overview of the case with Lou. Once we got, just a few minutes of discussion with him. Once he said that, we said yes. I mean, we're probably never going to turn anything down. But once we sort of got a quick background and an introduction to the parents, I think that a lot of our research was just sort of looking through some local news very quickly, and just as quickly discounted a lot of it. And so we ended up interviewing Goldia and Lawrence. We met them first. And that was really the start of our true research. We found where a lot of the inconsistencies were, some of the heartburn with how the case was, the disappearance was portrayed in the media and things like that. And so we were able to actually have a baseline to go off of to start our research. Unfortunately, there is a lot of information out there, and some of it is just, honestly, I can only say it's made up because there's no primary source for any of it. So we really talked to the parents and took what they had to say in first.
More than any other parents of a missing person, a child, Goldia and Lawrence, we spoke with Goldia more in depth because our conversation with Lawrence was just sort of a getting to know you conversation. They really need to have trust earned because they've had people reach out to them and be very passionate about Phoenix. And then from what Goldia was saying, they just kind of go away. They just kind of go away. They don't have an answer, so they move on. And you can see how someone would build up a wall. How did you overcome that with them? You said you spoke with them. I'm guessing you had to earn some trust there. How did you do that?
So I'm going to take credit for this. I used my secret weapon, Andy, to do so.
So my family understands one thing is if you are struggling to make a decision on something, I will talk to you and talk to you and talk to you until you make a decision. I am a talker, which is amazing that I've been so silent during this entire discussion. I've been pinching myself to be quiet. Yeah. Great discussions with Goldia and Lawrence, very enlightening in so many ways. There's so much more that exists. They are now in my mind, the keepers of the most important information in this case until we can get evidence, our hands on some serious evidence, right? Whether that's from the police or it's something that's discovered along the way through the investigation. But the discussions with Goldia initially, yeah, she's like Vanessa said, she's a very thick-skinned person, yet principled. And so it may seem that she's quick to offend, but I think it's an offense to her sensibilities and her principles. And so that's where she takes exception. I had to navigate that. I say me, because Vanessa and I had one first initial conversation with her. I think it was about an hour and a half long conversation with her and Lawrence. There were probably five times in that conversation, in that hour and a half, where I was pretty sure we were losing the client. I'm pretty sure we were losing her. Lawrence didn't seem too thrilled about opening up old wounds. Understandably, he knows what this does to Goldia, and he's been with her throughout this whole process, and he's tired too. So navigating that initial reticence was a challenge. They're less than, well, I'll put it diplomatically. Goldia can definitely put it the way she wants to put it, but they're less than favorable experience with a particular network, television network or entertainment network, True Crime Entertainment Network. It was not a good experience for them. That two-part series aired in 2018. She has not spoken to anyone since that aired. I don't know how long before it actually aired that the televised investigation happened. There was a lot of, like you said, there was a lot of trust to earn, some challenges, some hurdles to overcome. But at no point did I felt that we were going to lose the client. I knew we could keep her. I knew we could get her on board with getting back to work on this important case, important story. Thank you. Thank you for that. I really do like that important story, this important event. But I knew I could get her there, but I didn't know as a new investigator how hard to push. I'm not recruiting I'm not talking to a bad guy here. I'm not, I'm talking to somebody whose life has been turned upside down in every direction about their, you know, about something that's just twisting them up. So how hard do you push? How far do you go? This is all new to me and Vanessa. We spoke with Lou, got his advice early on. I'm glad we did that. You know, he gave us some reality points, I think, Vanessa, in an email response. He gave us a little bit of a reality check on how it is to work with clients who might be reluctant to do this kind of thing, that this is not new for private investigations for the missing. This is a very common thing, and you guys can attest to that, I'm sure.
And I think, too, a lot of what Andy did, I don't know if he remembers doing this, but
I was not drunk or otherwise incapacitated.
But I think the important thing is that it was a family to family conversation. So he told them about us and about our children and the things that we had gone through, honestly, and just sort of said, okay, yes, we're not law enforcement, which I think was actually a bonus for us. What was a good thing. And two, we have kids that are around the same age and we still call them kids. And that was a big thing for her. So I think that my strength is not necessarily, you know, the chatty, being able to really develop those kinds of relationships with people. And that is Andy all day long. And so I would even go as far as to say that they are friends, that Andy and the Coldens are friends. And they definitely know that I'm on their side. And so I think that's sometimes that's missing with people when they're talking to law enforcement and they're in the mix right then and the stress is right in front of them. It's hard sometimes to develop those connections right away, especially because we do overwork our law enforcement officers. Let's be very clear. We do overwork them. They don't have the kind of time that we do to focus on just one case or just a handful of cases. So I think that is another thing that private investigations for the missing brings to people, brings to families like this.
I love the dynamic the two of you have. Do you often play the good cop, bad cop, where Andy is the compassionate one and you're the one who's going in there and shaking them and saying, like, give me what you got? And then Andy's like pulling you out of the room. And then you have to sit down with the perp and say, you know, listen, she's going to come back in. She's going to be twice as mad when she comes back in. I feel like that's a good dynamic you guys have. Well done.
Okay. So I'm the bad cop. I would have never in a million years.
We've been told the Chip and Joanna Gaines of private investigations.
So can we talk a little bit about the police response on the day that Phoenix disappeared?
Phoenix walked out of her house around 3 or 3:30, and her car was found approximately 5:30-ish in East St. Louis. So they live in Spanish Lake. They lived in Spanish Lake, Missouri. And on the other side, Illinois, the other side of the river is East St. Louis. And so they, of course, have two different, state law enforcement systems that they use, different systems that they use for impounding cars. And even so, a lot of people say being so close, they should share information. But I mean, the truth is they don't. The states do the states thing. So the car was found around 5:30, was reported abandoned on the side of the road. And here's where I think stories kind of diverge it's attributed to a random journalist for a St. Louis newspaper that the car was found with the door open, the ignition was running, and it looked like a struggle, you know, so it looked like somebody was pulled out of the car. And because of that, that led a lot of people to go down, one, a human trafficking route, and two, people started comparing this situation to another situation in Atlanta, Georgia, where a lady was found
Stacey English.
Yes, Stacey English. Thank you. Sorry, my mind was blanking. Stacey English was found in the woods, and her car was found in a similar way, engine running, door open. So that piece of information kind of led different investigators down those two paths.
Sorry, I just want to interrupt real quick. Stacey English disappeared. It was about a week after Phoenix Colden?
Yes.
Okay. So that's why they've been kind of connected in that way.
Well, and also they're connected. They're loosely connected through a gentleman, and I'm going to name him. Robert Kirk is a gentleman who was at that time a music promoter, entertainer, entertainment promoter in the St. Louis-y St. Louis kind of scene. There is a suspected connection maybe between him, like socially, between him and Phoenix and the group of people that she was hanging out with at that time. The similarities in the car, how the vehicle was found. And like Vanessa said, initially reports were that that Phoenix's car was found in the middle of the lane with the door open and the engine running. Vanessa, you also said that there were signs of struggle. That actually, I don't know that's ever been reported.
Yes. So it was, I'm trying to remember the exact wording. And so I really shouldn't have characterized it that way. But basically, people thought just because of the way that the door was open, it was, you know, in the middle of the road and all of that,
right,
that it looked like somebody would have been forcefully removed from the car. Like it would.
It's a logical conclusion for most people to think, why is there a car in the middle of the road? And if they think that the door is open, but then, you know, later like we said in the previous interview, that information has changed. And Vanessa, we talked yesterday about when I kind of gave you an idea of what I was prepared to speak about with this event. When we were talking about this event yesterday, Vanessa, you talked about memories and what did you say? Misremembering?
Yes. So just to clarify, the car, the law enforcement officer that was dispatched to the scene said that he doesn't understand, he doesn't know where that information came from, that the car was parked off of the road, door closed, nothing of, nothing suspicious in the car. It just looked like it was a car that had sat on the side of the road abandoned because it ran out of gas. So those are his words. That's what he's sticking to. So I just wanted to clarify that. But yes, there are a lot of created memories sometimes with that. You say something or you hear something, and then it becomes a memory that you think you had, you know. And so we are dealing with the fact that people talked. There were a lot of rumors. And so some of these things that are stated as facts are just not facts. So there is a lot of digging and kind of analyzing that information to determine what's true and what's not.
And I would like to go back to, thanks, Ness, for clarifying that. And I would like to go back to that connection with Robert Kirk that suspected initially. He was cleared. I just want to make that clear. He was cleared of any wrongdoing. Moved off out of the state to another place. I'm sure he's living his life very happily and content right now with the way life is going outside of the spotlight of this particular case. And I, by bringing up his name, I by no means want to, you know, bring any unwanted attention to him personally. However, things at that time just looked outside the norm. And that's what Vanessa and I do. We lift every single rock we find. We're going to do it. And so I guess that's my message to anyone who might know where Phoenix is, might know how she's doing today. I think I'm just going to tell them now, Ness, that we don't, Vanessa and I, we do not walk past rocks without lifting them up. And I do believe that if, you know, I don't know how long, I can't make any promises. It's just like I told, we told Goldia and Lawrence, we make no promises, but I'm very confident in our training. And we fall back on our training. That's what we do. It's 20 some years of living like that. You just fall back on your training and you just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. Sometimes we've done, I'm so sorry to take this away from the case, but it is relevant in the sense that what kind of resources are we putting towards this, right? Our resources are limited right now. Absolutely. But Vanessa and I are very comfortable, or at least experienced with doing more with less. So we're going to make the most out of what we have. And as we get opportunities to gather more tools, more resources, I'm really confident that we're going to make real headway in this missing persons event.
How often are you working with the local law enforcement?
That's something that's interesting. So I have spoken with the, I don't know if they call it an NCOIC, a non-commissioned officer in charge, but he is the, I'll call him the desk sergeant for the Maryland State Police. I spoke with him on the phone about a licensing issue. And that is the extent of our interaction with the Maryland State Police. Vanessa has been preparing a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request, to the East St. Louis Police Department and the St. Louis Police Department. We don't know if those will be honored because we don't live in the state. And so if we have to reach out to an investigator who does live in the state, I'm sure private investigators for the missing can help us find an investigator in Missouri or in Illinois as needed to go and do that if that's required. But I think that's actually our next move, isn't it, Ness?
Yes. And we really haven't reached out to local law enforcement. Local to Missouri law enforcement very much, because a lot of what we want to do is just get the case material. And there's some tension there in the relationship between the Quildens. And so we feel that part of what we're trying to do is just sort of massage those relationships as much as we can, before we do any digging. And then once we're all able to travel, there will be a better opportunity for us to interact face to face. So we're trying to limit a lot of our over the phone or email conversations, just to keep from any miscommunication or any other tensions, or, you know, a feeling that we're maybe being accusatory, because we have to, there are people too, and that's gone on a lot with this case, with several cases actually in Missouri and in St. Louis. So.
Yeah, I would like to piggyback on that, to use a military vernacular, forgive me, but to go off of that one, Vanessa, I would say that it's reasonable to state as a matter of fact that any police department in this country that serves a population over a certain number, you know, whatever that threshold is, there's going to be a lot of things that get past them that slip through the nets. They can't catch everything. As a military intelligence professional myself, shame on me that I was working on 9/11. Okay. I missed it. We missed it. We all missed it. Things happen. But I think it's that intestinal fortitude for a police officer to be able to come forward and say, I made a mistake. I would like to help fix it. And here is the information as it really happened. And if you don't have that kind of intestinal fortitude, then you are a barrier to finding out exactly what it is that happened that day. And I would just ask that person or those people who understand, they just do something. Vanessa, I don't know if you feel the same way on that, but that I just feel that they are absolutely key to moving forward on this investigation. If we could just have them, you know, be transparent.
I mean, I of course, and not necessarily with this, but with any situation, especially when it deals with a missing person, I would ask that everyone be transparent, but we have to accept also that our limitation is really a human limitation. So there's going to be a protect your job, protect your friends, protect yourself, you know, not want to get in trouble forgetting after all this time, you know. So we're going to deal with that. And we're going to just, as you say, you know, I'll be the bad cop. And I ask that Andy, you know, Andy is going to, of course, he's better at kind of massaging those relationships. And I think that a lot of those folks, a lot of the police speak the same language as he does. So all we can do is try our best, try to overcome those barriers, just like he did with the Coldens.
And that's funny, you know, that I know it seems strange. I have, during this entire interview, I've been nothing but direct and kind of bold with my statements and my judgment. I don't withhold a lot of judgment on certain things, but I agree with you, Vanessa, 100%, that we need to be compassionate. We need to be patient. We need to be willing to have dialogue with these important people that have information on this case, on this missing persons event.
And I just want to go over a quick detail. I guess the timeline of Phoenix's disappearance. She left her house around 3 p.m. and her car was found about 2.5 hours later. So that really isn't a lot of time for her to do something or for something to happen. I mean, I guess it depends on your perspective. I take it Lawrence, Phoenix's dad, did not know where she was going, and the Coldens, they did not know where she was going when she left, and she didn't say goodbye. So what do you guys think about that? And do you know what her driving route was?
So we don't know the exact route, but we do know that the most direct way from her house to where her car was found is no more, I mean, just even kind of meandering, no more than 35 to 40 minutes. So it's easy for her. If she walks out, you know, 2 hours later, somebody reports, or, you know, an hour and a half or so later, somebody reports her car missing. I didn't see anything particularly that stood out about that. But yes, I do think that according to the Coldens, she would never leave the house without at least saying something, without some sort of acknowledgement. And so, you know, we've had teenagers, and they have stomped out of the house before without saying anything, but they make sure they're stomping out of the house. And, you know, there's always kind of that something that lets you know, okay, well, this person is definitely leaving and wants to make sure that I know. But they didn't have any indications that way. And so, you know, I do think that that's strange, you know, that she wouldn't have said anything if for so long. That's out of character, I guess I should say, for her.
And another one of the details that I just wanted to get your opinion on is the phone call that Goldia says Phoenix was on, or I don't remember if she said she received the phone call or she made a phone call, but she was on her phone when they went out, and that kind of agitated her. What's your opinion on that? Do you think that has any relevance to the disappearance?
I mean, honestly, we really couldn't say, you know, I would hesitate to say that could trigger anything. We do know that there were some tense moments between Phoenix and her parents. And so it could have been, you know, that was a call that she took while she was already angry about something else, or she was fine with her parents and then that call set her off. We would just be speculating at this point if we tried to tie anything together. But I will say that there is, we are working with the Coldens to get additional information and phone records. And I will say that there is an unusual pattern to the phone calls. There were several phone calls leading up to the day of her disappearance, and then they completely stopped afterwards. And I know that this has been speculated about as well in several different areas. But I would say that is one one thing that we would definitely like to look at, as well as the presence of more than one cell phone, which also could lead one down a certain line of thought.
Yeah, we don't have, we also have the ability to do forensics on these phones, right? And we don't know what forensics have been done by law enforcement. I'm assuming they've done some. We don't know what the results of those forensics were. So that kind of, again, ties our hands as investigators on that part until we can get that information from them and then help them with the investigation. Vanessa, I want to go back to you pointing that out earlier. It really should be a partnership. Maybe it's because we're not cops, Ness.
Heck yeah, I totally agree. I think that what Bruce is trying to provide with private investigations for the missing has that element to it, a very heavy focus on making this a Swiss Army knife for law enforcement. And you open it up and you have investigators that span the country looking into several different cases. And who knows, a decade from now, 15 years from now, it's synonymous with, NamUs or one of those organizations, and very productive, very motivated with individuals like yourselves looking into these and not just focused on the details of a disappearance, but nurturing relationships with families. Just the peace of mind, that's another element that I know Bruce is very heavily focused on, is allowing or providing peace of mind to families and providing a relationship to families. And that is really goes much further than I think people think, that someone knows, hey, someone's looking into this. You might not have you might not solve it, you may, but just having that person to go to, those people to go to and check in, and vice versa. I think that's a often underrated element to the whole thing.
When a person goes missing, their loved ones often find themselves overcome with worry and grief. Bruce Maitland started the 501c3 nonprofit organization Private Investigations for the Missing because he knows this feeling all too well.
When Bruce's daughter Brianna disappeared in March 2004, he was surrounded by licensed private investigators dedicated to finding her. Now his mission is to provide dedicated private investigators at no cost to other families of the missing, desperate for answers but without the financial means.
Private Investigations for the Missing needs your help. To read the mission statement, make a donation, and keep up with our blog, visit us at investigationsforthemissing.org and follow us at PI for the Missing on Twitter and Facebook and Investigations for the Missing on Instagram.
Because forever is too long to wait.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.